Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mixed Mental Arts, recording here at the Griffith Observatory, looking out the vast expanse that is Brian Callen's empire, Los Angeles, California. We can see where the Emperor's house is, and then, you know, all the women who are in his harem who don't actually realize that they're in his harem because they actually don't know who he is. But in Brian's mind, they belong to him. And it is my extreme pleasure to have on the podcast our resident Chinese linguist and ambassador from the court of the Qin Dynasty, Isaiah Guli. Isaiah, welcome to the podcast.
Neiman Hao.
Now, the first thing is, Isaiah, is we should probably get you to pronounce the word Chengyu, which I butchered.
Yes. It's Chengyu, which is, Chinese is a tonal language, which makes zero sense to English speakers because tone is an indicator of emotion or inflection or, you know, whatever subtext of what you're actually saying
in English.
In
yeah.
English. Whereas tone is an indicator of meaning directly to the individual, syllable that you're speaking.
So from my shitty high school Chinese experience, right, the example they give is the five ways to say ma, right?
Yeah. Ma, 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 ma.
And what they mean different things. So what do they mean?
There's something like 30 or 40 distinct morphemes. A morpheme is a individual piece of language, a sound, essentially. There's only about 40 of those, and each one can have four tones, but you can have the same morpheme and tone mean any number of things. Like, I'm trying to think of a good example offhand. Like, sure, fourth tone, means is, it's a stative verb. But like, sure, sure means teacher, and I'm trying to remember the tone for line, but it's also sure. I think it's second tone. Sure is also a different meaning. It means lion or rock.
And this is why even, you know, that there's often with any foreign language. So we were talking last night, you do this as part of the intelligence community, and Chinese is a class 5 language.
Yeah, I think it's actually category 4. English is a category 5. I haven't looked at the actual way that they delineate it, but the more difficult the language is, the more you get paid, essentially.
And Chinese, part of the real challenge for English speakers is this tone thing,
yes,
which is so much of why most people never even get past basic Chinese, because they never figure out the tones right. I remember we took, in high school, I took Chinese for an entire year, and then we did this exchange program to Beijing. And
how'd that go?
We were very excited. We were like, oh my God, it's so great. We're going to have great Chinese food, and we're going to speak Chinese. And then we showed up, and there was a Chinese professor at, I'm going to butcher this, but Beijing Shifan Danshui, Beijing Normal University.
Beijing Shifan Danshui.
Yeah, see, there you go. Right there it was the problem, because we got into the first class and we're excited to learn all sorts of things. And the Chinese teacher is like, your tones suck.
Yeah.
So for the next 2 weeks, all we're going to do is tones.
Yeah.
And so you go from feeling fairly confident about your Chinese to suddenly having to go back, and he's just like, ma.
Yeah. Nobody can see this, but Hunter just did the fantastic thing called tone hands,
mm-hmm.
which, there's four tones in Chinese with a neutral tone. That neutral tone is something else, and I'm not going to get into the esoteric nature of Chinese, but first tone is flat tone, ma, like you put your hand out and flat like it's on a table. Second tone is rising tone, like you're asking a question, like there's a question mark at the end of a sentence. Ma? So that's an incline. Third tone is like a trough. You go down and then up. So it's like ma. And fourth tone is falling, like you're cursing at somebody. Ma!
And so when I shared with Brian your first... exactly, but I literally had to, like, it was amazing because
it was
like
beautiful. I saw it. I saw it when I heard it. I was like, "Tian Gao Huang Di. Yes. It was beautiful.
But see, this is where it becomes sad that this podcast isn't recorded on video, because you also would have seen me go up and down like a jack in the box of like, Tian Go.
Yeah. Well, that's how you learn it. Yeah. That's how you learn it. Everybody learns it that way. I don't know how they learn it in China. I know a lot of Chinese people, mm-hmm. but like the way that they learn it, they also use the romanization script that we use since Mao invented it.
Well, and that's the funny secret, is it's a great example of cultural borrowing, yeah. where they're like, oh, okay, we're still going to write in Chinese characters, but actually this pinyin, this romanization, makes it much easier to teach kids the language, yeah. right? It's an easy way into the language, and then once you've learned it with the pinyin, then you're going to learn it with the Chinese characters.
Yeah. Yeah, that... It's a lifetime of practice. Like... I know a lot of linguists, a lot of people who have been doing this job for 30, 40 years, and those guys still even need to practice all the time. You can never be a master of what you start. Like,
well, and to some extent, I mean, you know, even think about English.
Yeah.
We're native speakers of English. Do we really master English? Well, to some extent, we don't. I mean, you know, how much Shakespeare and Chaucer, and how much of all the various poets and the various writers, and English has, I think, it's one of the largest vocabularies, hundreds of thousands of words. Most of us don't know most of those words.
Yeah, and...
I mean, none of us knows all those words.
Yeah, and nobody knows where they come from, you know, why they're set up that way. It's... You can be fluent in a language. Fluent is a nebulous term, but you can be fluent in a language and not know, you know, how to tell somebody to change a tire on your car.
Yeah, because that's a very specific use case. Or, you know, even if you're fluent in English, you know, go try and read some sort of medical text.
Yeah.
Suddenly you find that your fluency in English doesn't amount to shit.
It's a funny story about that. I've been listening to a lot of Chris Ryan lately, full disclosure. And of course, Chris Ryan talks a lot about sex. And so when I was like 12, 13 years old, my mom had a whole bunch of encyclopedias, like the World Book from 1994 and like a bunch of medical textbooks. And when you're, you know, 12, 13, 14 and you're a boy, you're getting hit with a lot of hormones. So you think about sex a lot. So me... being the bookish individual that I am, opened the medical encyclopedia and began reading as much as I could about the biology of sex. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
You have to have a technical appreciation to really appreciate.
Yeah, it's like appreciating cars. You can appreciate the beauty of a car, but you don't really understand cars until you understand the engine.
Until you get under the hood. Yeah, exactly.
Until you get under that hood, baby.
And I think, you know, so in terms of getting under the hood of languages,
there is
a whole other level of appreciation that you have for languages when you start to understand, when you're not just a casual user of language, but you're starting to understand the mechanics, you're starting to understand how it works together, you're understanding levels of function, like even the sort of distinction that you draw between, you know, English has tone.
Yeah.
But it uses tone for a totally different function, which is to convey sort of subtext or intent.
Yes.
So if we take some of my verbal tics, there's the word right, as in that's right.
Yes.
And that's definitive and declarative.
Yes.
And then there's the way that I love to use it, which is to say right.
Yeah.
Right. And suddenly now it's a question.
Yeah.
So we're using tone all the time in English, but it's not used necessarily to convey meaning, whereas it's in Chinese, as you said, that's...
And it very, like, there's a lot of issues with linguistics, like the nuts and bolts of it, as far as the nomenclature, because in Chinese, so I speak Chinese Mandarin, and there's like 7 recognized dialects of Chinese. They're not dialects. They're literally different languages. The only reason why they're grouped as dialects of different languages is because of political reasons. So,
well, there's that old line that, you know, the difference between a dialect and a language is an army.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely true. And it, what I, you know, Chinese is a great example of that, yeah. where Mandarin is really, as I understand it, sort of the Beijing dialect.
Yes.
And then they've tried to speak Putonghua and write standard characters.
Yeah.
So they've tried to, they've basically said, this dialect of Chinese is the correct dialect, and yeah. we're going to impose that on the rest of the country, which was very much the same thing that the French did
yeah.
with Parisian French yeah. becoming. So, you know, that France, for example, had all these different languages like Provençal and Occitan.
Yeah.
And then the Parisians were like, no, those are bastardizations. The true French is what we speak in Paris. And now you're all going to speak like Parisians.
Yeah, I was just in Spain, and so I rode a motorcycle basically 2,000 miles winding around Spain from Barcelona mm-hmm. To Jerez, and like every region has its own different language, and they're not really even dialects of Spanish. Like Basque is confusing as a language.
Basque is just not even related to Spanish at all.
Yeah, it's like Gaelic. It's an orphan language. I was reading an article about that the other day. How I think it was posted on the Mixed Mental Arts Facebook page about how the Basque are descended on Neanderthals.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting how the Basque language is like a linguistic orphan. And also, like, Catalan is, you can't, like, when I was walking through the streets of Barcelona, it's like people are speaking Catalan and they're speaking Spanish. And I'm like, I thought this was Spain and everybody spoke Spanish. It's like everybody does speak. I started speaking my poor Chicano Spanish that I learned from being from California. And they said, oh, your Castellano is pretty all right. And I'm like, okay. I'm all right with this.
Well, and it crucially, it's a real political decision. If you're in Barcelona and you're speaking Catalan, you're yeah. signaling that that's your identity.
Yeah.
And then if you're speaking Spanish or Castellano, as they call it,
yeah.
that's a whole other political thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, so much of this comes down to tribal identity.
Yeah.
And what nations are trying to do is trying to forge a larger tribal identity.
Yeah.
And so other tribal identities become threatening to them.
Yeah.
And they're trying to subjugate those tribal identities in favor of the larger one.
Yeah.
And there's this, you know, when I was in Beijing, yeah, there were all these signs all over the big sites that said speak Putonghua and write yeah. standard characters.
Yeah.
Which Putonghua is the official dialect.
It Putonghua, or in the People's Republic of China, it's called Putonghua. In the Republic of China, also known as Taiwan, it's called Guoyu. And in Hong Kong, they also call it Guoyu, because they're speaking towards a larger ethnic identity of Chinese people being, we're all China, the Pan-Han
mm-hmm.
is the way that I like to think of it, because it is the standard language, and they do use it as a means to, I'm going to say, crack down on dissidents. But at the same time, it's like, I'm from California, and there's a lot of Asian people here, and not many of them who started off like in the 1800s before the Chinese Exclusion Act, not many of those people speak Putonghua as their first language. They predominantly speak Cantonese
mm-hmm.
or primarily Cantonese, because they shipped the workers over from Guangzhou, which is in South China, which is,
that's basically, you know, just across the water from Hong Kong Island, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's... Well, yeah. There's a... The province is Guangdong, and the main city there is... It's Shenzhen, Guangzhou, the
yeah.
giant metropolitan area. But yeah, that's where they shipped them from. But the reason why they shipped them from there is because during the before the first Opium War, that was the only place where... foreign sailing ships could do business.
Mm.
So,
yeah. So this goes back to so the Chinese had very little interest with in engaging with the West.
Yeah. In 1793, the I think it was the Guangxu Emperor was visited by a British emissary, British ambassador of the Queen, and the ambassador was trying to establish a trade network, but the ambassador did not understand anything about Chinese culture, and he didn't do any of the rituals that would be required, and he didn't understand that you don't talk to the emperor to try and get shit done in China. China's an interesting place. But back to the story, he went to the emperor, tried to establish this thing, and there was a group of edicts. It's the Qianlong emperor, mm-hmm. not Guangxu Huangdi, Qianlong, the thousand-year dragon.
Amazing. How do you top that name? Can we call you that, Isaiah? Can we call you the thousand-year dragon?
I'm not that amazing.
We might have to call Chris Ryan the thousand-year dragon. Can we call him that?
Yes. Or just Lao Tzu. But the Qianlong emperor issued several edicts saying essentially what it boils down to, you're a fucking peasant moron asking me to establish trade for shit that I don't need in this country of great wonder. You and everyone around this world is subordinate to me, the son of heaven. Fuck off, essentially.
It's
a very eloquent way of saying fuck off.
But crucially, and you know, I think, because I remember learning about this, and when you think about the quality of China, as in mm-hmm. literally the porcelain,
yeah.
and you compare it to the crap, the textiles,
yeah.
and like, you know, you compare Chinese silk to the crap that the British textile yeah. mills were producing, it's pretty understandable that the emperor had this reaction. It was clearly a subordinate yeah. material, clearly shitty manufacture.
Well, but British guns were better than Chinese ones.
Well, and that was the crucial difference, is that so
yeah.
the Chinese basically established these trading conditions where
yeah.
you can, the British are welcome to buy whatever they want
yep.
in return for silver and gold, and but they aren't allowed to sell anything in return.
Yeah, yeah, they, yeah, that's the basic of it. And it was only silver, not silver
only,
and gold.
Yeah, only silver.
Yeah, yeah, that's part of under the Canton system. If you're speaking the Queen's English, whenever I think of speaking the Queen's English, I always think of like really poorly spoken imitations of the Southern accent.
Well, thank God Brian isn't here, because then Brian would be doing his, we'd have to listen for 5 minutes as he did his Scottish aristocrat and his various other impressions of the Queen's English.
I feel like that would enrich all of our lives, because Brian Callen enriches all.
That is what the emperor does. Yes. That Brian is Callen is the Qianlong emperor, the thousand-year dragon.
Yes, yes. I'm gonna think of a name for him, like the Kalan Huangdi.
what would Kalan Huangdi mean?
I don't know. It's just a transliteration. No, but I haven't looked at characters.
We'll have to think of what the characters would be yeah. for Kalan Huangdi. But so and then this all turns when suddenly the Europeans start to force the Chinese to trade reciprocally.
Well, when they garnered the ability to force. It's not that they wouldn't want to force before. China prior to the Opium Wars was the longest established, most powerful, most cohesive and, you know, centralized state in the world, with the biggest economy, most surplus, most agriculture, largest population of any country or country. It wasn't really a country until 1911.
Yes.
Any
state.
Sort of polity.
Yeah, polity.
Until the Opium War, China was China. You know, it was the Chinese name for China, and colloquially is Zhongguo, the middle country, and there's a lot of connotations put to that. But within a lot of the philosophy that governed the state, it meant that it's the center of the world, and everything is radiating circles off of it. for the benefit of the Son of Heaven.
Well, and crucially, that sort of idea that our people are the center of the world is a pretty universal concept that a lot of cultures come up with.
It's the same thing as American exceptionalism.
Exactly.
Different names for the same thing.
Different names for the same thing. And even on in terms of smaller tribes, I always find it fascinating. The number of tribes where when you look at what does their tribe's name mean, they call themselves the people.
Yeah.
So everybody sort of thinks of themselves as the people, and then there are those other weirdos.
Yeah. Have you seen this YouTube series called Crash Course?
Yes. Done by John Green.
John and Hank Green, the brothers Green.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. It's really great. But they did an episode on Greek and the origin of the word barbarian. And it's the people who say bar, 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 bar.
Well, and in Russian, the word for Germans is Nemetsky, which is like the people who say nothing or something like that. So, you know, this sort of idea that basically we're the real deal, and then there's these other bizarros who really make no sense is pretty common. But so in the Opium Wars, what happens is the British find that they can deal drugs. They can be drug dealers, and that's how they can
They can find a commodity that has a demand and fill that demand.
Which is drugs.
Which is, I mean, I smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol. Those are drugs too.
Yeah. And pharmaceuticals, there are lots of drug dealers. So it's not, I'm not putting a judgment on drug dealers.
It is a charged word though, especially in this culture where anything that alters your state of consciousness is automatically bad because Protestant work ethic and abstinence and temperance and work the land until you die. It's a fucked up notion that doesn't, really describe reality, in my opinion. But yes, they were drug dealers.
They were drug dealers. And the result is that what you end up with is these treaty ports.
Yes.
To go back to sort of like, you know, Guangzhou.
Treaty of Nanjing, 1842.
Mm-hmm. And so there are a series of these treaty ports all around China, and different countries are based in different treating ports. So crucially, Qingdao beer, I believe, came out of the German treaty port.
Second Opium War is when, if I remember correctly, when Germany wasn't even established until 1872. But, they established that treaty port. It's not really a treaty port. They had control over the entire Shandong Peninsula.
And so you end up with this cultural exchange back and forth where the Chinese learn beer making from Germans.
Yes.
And that's why Qingdao beer is this great cross-cultural collaboration between...
And it's all right.
Okay, it's not a great cross-cultural, but it actually pairs quite well with Chinese food, I think.
Well, yeah. It tastes a lot like Kolsch. The beer of Cologne. Cologne is a wonderful city.
Yeah.
But it tastes a lot like Kolsch. It's a good lager beer.
Yeah, it's very light and with sort of spicy food or with rich Chinese food.
Yeah.
It seems to work quite
well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's this cultural exchange that's happening back and forth between the various treaty ports and the various countries. But crucially, the Chinese find themselves in much the same place with this where, you know, they have this mess of languages.
Yes.
And they're trying to form a more and more cohesive polity.
Yes.
And so they're trying to basically deal with these other identities in the same way that the Spanish have to deal with people who speak Catalan and Basque. And, I mean, the story that I love is in repeatedly you find that cultures innovate this practice of like what they did in Provence. I think it was in Provence and Aquitaine. The French had what they called the vergogne, which was they would take a child who was speaking the foreign language and they would hang a sign that said, "I am an idiot, I speak Provençal," around their neck.
Yeah.
And then that kid had to find someone else who spoke that language before the end of the day, and then they would pass that sign on. And whoever was stuck with the sign at the end of the day would be beaten. And so what this does is it not only makes the creates a strong disincentive to speak your local language, the language you speak at home. It also creates mistrust within the community.
Yeah.
And that destabilization then makes it easier for the central power to impose their will.
That's
on...
the same thing that Mao did with the Cultural Revolution.
There you go.
There's no different.
So that's what these patterns emerge in these cultures where you find that the same sort of approaches, let's not even call them solutions, emerge that are trying to form larger and larger political units.
Yeah, there's that old saying, there's nothing new under the sun, and that to me gets back to the way that groups work and the nature of human groups and how humans interact in groups. There are ways to do things. Now there are different ways to do a lot of things, but for some things there's only one way to do it. If you want to destroy a group, you got to give them a Carthaginian peace. So
yeah, now that's strong stuff there. So and you're referencing the Punic Wars,
yes.
Right, between Rome and Carthage, and there was this phrase that was being said throughout these three Punic Wars, and you know, it was Carthago delenda est, Carthage must be destroyed.
Yeah.
And then after the Punic Wars, they not only destroyed Carthage, but they salted the earth,
yeah,
so that no food could grow there again.
Yes.
And there's the famous saying, they made a desert and they called it peace.
Yes.
So, you know, cultures have to, again and again, you have to destroy the old culture to be able to then bind those people into the new culture.
Bind is a good word in this. Maybe not bind them to it, but enact bondage upon them.
In some sense. And the challenge is essentially... And I think a large part of what we're trying to do with Mixed Mental Arts is to have a more consensual form of people.
Ladies and gentlemen, consent matters.
Consent matters. And I think that, yeah, if we could start to create sort of intentional cultural mixing and people can find their way in and sort of evolve their own mixed culture.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the beauty of Mixed Mental Arts, is that it evolves organically and real cultural integration is organic, because like if you look at a lot of examples throughout history, like the Meiji Restoration, it was a situation in which they tried to deliberately do a lot of things and it didn't really work, and that's how you ended up with the Second World War. Like there's a direct path from the Meiji Restoration to the Second World War.
Well, they're just sort of like throwing it on top of the underlying culture. And so it's not really integrated into the belief system and the values.
Yes. Yes. That's a very, very good way of putting it. But, I think the greater point is that it's like the old lady who swallowed the fly. Mm-hmm. If you try to swallow a cat eventually, or if you try to swallow a spider to get the fly, eventually you're going to swallow a cat and a lion and a tiger, whatever, bears, oh my.
Explain the story to me.
So the old lady who swallowed a fly, there was an old lady who swallowed a fly, something something something, and she swallows a spider to catch the fly, swallows a
so she swallows the fly, the fly's inside of her.
Yeah.
She wants to deal with the fly, so
yeah,
she has to swallow a spider to deal with the fly.
Yeah. And then she swallows something that will kill like a rat to kill the spider, and then a cat to kill the rat, and then a dog to kill the cat. And it's like the situation in Australia with importing the foxes to kill all the toads.
Oh, yeah.
And,
well, and you know, the rabbits get imported, and then
yeah,
they have to deal with the rabbits by
yeah,
myxomatosis. So the point is that you keep on trying to solve this original problem and just keep on making it worse and
yeah,
worse and worse. Okay.
Yeah.
So now I know that story. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
But I think the moral of that story isn't, you know, try and find a better way to take care of the problem. It's the old lady who swallowed the fly, she'll just digest the fly.
Yeah.
Things happen organically. And that's a beauty of cultural interaction, is that you take what works, get rid of what's not.
Yeah.
Add what's uniquely your own. It's like Mexican food.
Uh-huh.
like especially California Mexican food. And I tried to explain this to somebody at a Mexican restaurant once when I said I wanted to get carne asada fries. They're like, why would you want French fries with carne? It like didn't click to them. And then we got it and they're like, oh my God, carne asada fries.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's like Del Taco.
Yeah.
I go to Del Taco. I get, you know, hard tacos, a hamburger, a little burrito, and chili cheese fries. You can't get that in Mexico.
No, no. And I mean, even that's what's fascinating. The thing that I love most in terms of all Mexican food is tacos al pastor.
Oh, those are great.
Those are amazing. And I looked into the history of it a little bit. Turns out it was some Lebanese guys moved to Mexico and they're like, shawarma. We're going to make shawarma in Mexico. And then originally they started off doing it with lamb because that's what they had done back in Lebanon. And so they're making shawarma tacos essentially. But then it becomes clear that these non-Muslims prefer pork. So then tacos al pastor becomes done with pork.
Yeah.
And then they start adding in pineapple and this and that. And then you have modern tacos al pastor. But it is this organic cultural borrowing. And then people improv off of that. And they say, we love what you're doing with this tacos shawarma, but now we're going to twist it and we're going to make it this new thing and on and on and on. And it just keeps on evolving.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how things that are awesome come about organically. Anytime you try to force something, you end up with the Holocaust at its natural end.
Well, because essentially what happens is that you have, this is the big problem of these top-down solutions, is you start off with a small number of individuals who actually has very limited knowledge. They don't know much. And then they have a vision, they impose it. Then the people who don't have power start showing problems with the vision.
Yeah.
And then rather than saying, oh, you make a really good point. Like, yeah, that is a problem. Let's evolve something better together. They're like, what do you mean? Fuck you. Like, you know, eh. And eventually you end up using coercion and force to try and impose what is actually a shitty, poorly thought out vision.
Yeah.
And great examples of that are anything from the Soviets.
Yeah. Well, We brought up this conversation last night. Me and Hunter had some wonderful food.
With Nicole.
And I made
your other new best friend, BG.
Oh, yeah. What a wonderful man. What a wonderful man. I was the only one who was drinking heavily. So
I don't know about that. There were cigars. There was beer. There was delicious tacos. Yes. I don't know if they weren't carne asada, really.
It was barbacoa.
Barbacoa, yeah. And then, it was great. It was a great night.
It was wonderful. But the point is, I brought up, what's the difference between Stalin and Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, there's no difference between Stalin and Hitler or Qin Shi Huang, the first Chinese emperor. They took over an area, enacted their will upon the area. Lots of people died. Lots of people fucking rebelled. In the end, there's no difference. You know, there's a saying by Deng Xiaoping, the premier, former premier of China, who took over after Mao, translated, it's, doesn't matter if the cat's black or the cat's white, if it catches mice, it's a good cat. And that to me can be extrapolated and placed on the black cat of Hitler and the white cat of Stalin. They caught their mice, but they weren't good cats.
No, not at all. And
so, well, and if they don't catch mice, they're bad cats.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, or it depends on what you count as catching a mouse.
Oh, yeah.
So I would say that Hitler and Stalin didn't catch mice because they didn't deliver good societies.
Exactly.
And you know, the what Deng Xiaoping is saying, because crucially Deng Xiaoping rejected the Maoist way.
Yes.
And embraced essentially capitalism.
Socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Okay, there you go. I'm sorry. Listen, I'm gonna, by the end of this, I might be speaking. I'm not excited necessarily to have the orthodoxy of the Chinese Communist Party, but I am excited that by the end of this podcast, I might speak Putonghua.
A little bit. A little bit.
A little bit.
Well, you can make Chinese tacos.
Yeah, that would be amazing. That would be good.
Well, it's like Eddie Huang with his Bauhaus.
Those are awesome.
Those are like Chinese tacos.
Yeah, they are really, really good.
Yeah, and you wouldn't get that. You wouldn't get that in China.
No, you would not. You know, you would not. That's always what's fascinating, too. Like, even, you know, when you go to Dubai, you go walk around any mall in Dubai, and literally every food from every imaginable culture is there.
Yeah.
But it just makes me so sad because they don't mix.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. I've always been fascinated in terms of, say, East LA.
Yeah.
You think about it. You have all these guys who are working as cooks in all of these different, you know, restaurants all over LA. They're exposed to, they have the skills to make every cuisine.
Yeah.
And then they go back to East LA or wherever, and you've got this amazing set of skills. And if they would start comparing notes and evolving fusion cuisine together, East LA would be the restaurant place in the world.
100%. I mean, it's, I think that might speak to the larger problem of communities, like how structures are set up. So if you have a structure set up that lets people do what they do organically, they're going to intermingle and mix. But because, like, it's so competitive to be a chef in a good restaurant, you're automatically going to set up conditions for a game where people are trying to nudge out other people instead of being like, this is a win-win if we do this.
Well, but it's also, I mean, I think there are a bunch of things. One, there are sort of cultural values of feeling comfortable borrowing, feeling comfortable experimenting.
Yes.
And not a lot of cultures have that. And that's not a, you know, that sort of experimentality is not something that, for example, you find in a place like Dubai, or that you would find, I think, probably in East LA.
Yeah.
And that sort of spirit of play and experimentation and being okay with failure is pretty important. I think the other thing too is that you need a good on-ramp. So you think about, like, for example, Roy Choi, whom, you know, speaking of deliciousness, made the Korean barbecue burrito.
Yeah.
And he has, there's, you know, I think food trucks, what's so great about food trucks is that they're a great incubator for new cuisine where you can experiment, you can get feedback from the world, you can see what succeeds. Oh, that worked well. Now we can scale up to 2, 3, 4 food trucks. And then, you know, now Roy Choi has restaurants.
Yeah. It's like the democratization of any sector.
Right.
And that's to large part what's happening in music right now, which is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, there's so many great bands who are combining so many different things because the record industry died.
Yeah. Well, and the tools have just become so much cheaper
and
more accessible.
So there's a low cost of entry to the environment, and there's no gatekeepers. Because, like, I literally just recorded an album in my house and published it by myself without spending a dime.
Mm-hmm.
So
doesn't get any better than that, and that wouldn't have been possible 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago.
Yeah. It would be impossible.
Like, yeah.
It's so mind-blowing.
Yep.
And to speak to, like, you see, like, peaks and troughs of innovation with music, especially, like, the development of the blues was a function of the end of Reconstruction because it put a lot of people out of work and a lot of people had to go and find something to make money. So what they do, they got a guitar and hit the road. And that's how you get Son House and Robert Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have the end of Reconstruction. Like, if Reconstruction had gone on and worked and everybody was, you know, doing awesome shit and Black people were equal to white people in the South, you wouldn't have the blues.
So, yeah, just to unpack that. So, essentially, you have Reconstruction, the Civil War has ended, and now you're starting to try and reform Southern society to make it less racist, make it more inclusive, everybody have more opportunities. And you're saying if that path of sort of development and integration had happened, that essentially that the African-American community would have been integrated into society and they wouldn't have been fallen on such hard times and been forced to find ways to compete, and that the only thing they could really compete with was music.
Yeah. Like, people are always going to find a way.
Yeah.
And that's shown throughout history, is that people are going to find a way. It might take a while. And you might need a lot of people to stand up and say, fuck you, we're not doing this. Take this job and shove it. Mm-hmm. You might need a lot of people to do that, but people are always going to find a way.
Well, and this is where I think all the evolutionary biology and the cultural evolution is helpful, because what you're talking about is that organisms exploit ecological niches.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ecological niches that exist where, oh, there's an opportunity there for an organism that can, for example, clean the mouths of sharks.
Yeah.
And amazingly, there is an organism that has evolved to fill that ecological niche,
yeah.
And it cleans the mouths of sharks.
And the shark doesn't eat it because it needs its mouth cleaned.
And that is a weird collaboration. The idea of a fish that just sort of, you know, is the shark dentist and
yeah.
doesn't get eaten by the shark. But that's the power of evolution, is that there are gaps in the free market of
yeah.
genetics, and somebody comes in and exploits them.
Yeah, that's the irony of the red and tooth and claw paradigm, is that if everything were to kill everything else, nothing would be alive.
Yeah. And there needs to be a certain amount of experimentation. There needs to be, and crucially, I mean, there's a really great example of cooperation, right? There's cooperation
yeah.
between the shark and, what is it, the...
I think it's the pilot fish.
Pilot fish.
Could be wrong.
But
I'm not
probably.
I'm not a biologist.
Nor, you know.
Brian Callen would know.
Brian Callen would know, but apparently I'm not a biologist either. Sam Harris has told me that I am wrong about the relevant biology and half the biology. So now that I know that I'm not a biologist, it's great, because I can just say that I don't know, and then later I can Wikipedia it.
Oh, of course, of course.
Whereas Sam doesn't have to ever Wikipedia things. Those pupils, he definitely didn't just look up some statistics that make Arabs look bad. So on that note, what we're seeing is that people will exploit an ecological niche, but crucially, we have to set up that mixing, and we have to make it easier for that borrowing and that stealing. And in some areas of endeavor,
yeah.
that happens pretty easily because there aren't barriers. Like, it's not like musicians sit around and they're like, oh, I don't know. Am I allowed to combine the blues with, with hip hop and rap and
yeah.
gospel? No, they just do it because they're focused on what sounds cool and what works. And that doesn't happen usually in the world of ideas.
Well, that's because the culture of creative endeavors is to create. Like, you don't get something as awesome as, you know, the Black Keys if you don't have. You don't have an environment that says, do you. And for a long time, what they did was just straight up blues. And then they started taking more and started taking more, diffusing more and more and more. And like the last record that they came out with has echoes of Tom Petty in it. It has echoes of Prince in it. It's just something completely new, you know? And it's carne asada fries.
Yeah, and that's the point of mixed mental arts, is carne asada fries.
Yes.
If you have an idea and you're excited, and part of it is, you know, we've been talking about this with music. Like, I wrote a thing, Smart Goes Pop, all about where you look at what happened. Andrews Erickson does this original research on how practice leads to expertise, right? And
yeah.
then out of all of that research, the bit that Malcolm Gladwell pulls out is the 10,000-hour rule.
Yeah.
And then Macklemore is like, oh, that's an awesome idea. And then he makes this awesome song, 10,000 Hours. Now, the crucial thing is that's the diffusion of innovations. That's
yeah.
the movement of ideas. Now, Anders Ericsson says, well, you know, Malcolm Gladwell focused on the 10,000-hour rule, and that's an oversimplification and all of that. But guess what? Most people are never going to read Anders Ericsson's original research.
Yeah.
And so if even a little bit of that research gets out into an awesome song, well, then that opens up for someone else to do another song that says, and do you know how you do that 10,000 hours? It's about slowing down. It's about deliberate practice.
Yeah.
It's about really improving. So but that's what we want to get going, is smart going pop, where people are taking these ideas and remixing and creating their own
creating heuristics.
Yeah, creating heuristics, rules of thumbs. And that's crucially what you were doing, especially that's what you're saying about, watch me butcher the Chinese language. Chung Yu.
Yeah, close enough.
Closer.
You gotta, like, you're... So that morpheme yu is a morpheme that we don't have in English, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of people fuck it up. It's hilarious.
Yeah, so...
Because you're sitting there... No. Yu.
Yu.
Yu. No, for like 15 minutes.
Well, there's a lot more lip rounding in the Chinese one, right?
Yeah. It's like a umlaut in German.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, cheng yu.
Yeah.
Okay. That's closer. Better. Closer. And we'll closely approximate. I mean, again.
You need 10,000 hours.
Yeah. You really do need 10,000 hours. And that's the point, is you can get hung up on the exact number of 10,000 hours as Anders Ericsson did.
Or
you can just recognize that it's a shit ton of practice. And that's the point of the 10,000 hour rule.
Well, and that's like. Like you mentioned in a previous podcast about 72 virgins, 72 just means a fuck ton.
Yeah.
They have that in Chinese too. Bai, it means 100, but it means a fuck ton. Qian, qian means 1,000. It means a whole fuck ton.
Yeah.
And wan means 10,000. And it's, God damn it, we're going to need a lot.
But so, you know, even when is it that comes up in a Cheng Yu about like a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's I can't remember.
But we're not getting super literal about, well, is it 1,000? Is it 999 miles?
It's a goddamn metaphor, people.
Yeah, it's a goddamn metaphor. But crucially, and some people don't understand metaphors, but
go ahead. I have a story about that. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Tell the tell the story about people who don't get stories.
Who don't. So no, I was in Goodfellow Air Force Base, Texas, right? And we were out drinking at a daiquiri bar.
Oh.
And we met this girl who, long story short, she was not, you know, quite well-read.
She hadn't done her sharpest tool in the shed.
Yes. Yes, she was dumb. And you know, we recognize this because we're all assholes. And we kind of started making fun of her in a hyperbolic manner. And my friend said, she took us completely literally when we did that. And my friend literally stopped and said, do you understand what hyperbole is? People don't understand stories. Go on.
Well, so funnily enough, so have you ever had Castle Mine 4X?
No.
It's an Australian beer. I don't know if it's any good. But when I was growing up in England, they had always the best ads on TV.
Yeah.
And there was one that they had, which caused a big shitstorm of controversy. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube, where they started off and it's like one of those sad African tragedy documentary fundraising things.
Yeah.
Where they, you know, it's this man has to walk, you know, 1,000 miles to get a drink of water. And then when he gets there, the watering hole is dry, and so he must suck moisture from the frog, and you know, blah blah blah. It's just like really tragic and sad and shitty. And then all of a sudden walks into this camera, this, you know, skinny, tall, much younger African dude, and you know, they just like pan out of the shot, and there's like a sort of roadside stand that's like covered in Castle Mine Forex, and he says, one beer please. And he goes, Dad never was the sharpest tool in the shed.
yeah.
but the point is that very often, you know, people are focused on these, you know, oh, it's so difficult, when there's an easy solution right there, and people just don't understand that these metaphors and these stories and these heuristics or rules of thumb have always existed. And so I think what's so cool about your Cheng Yu is that
there you go.
Yeah, we're starting to get there. But what I think is so cool about them is, you know, you read Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and they're acting as if there's this great new insight that people think with rules of thumb or heuristics. But in fact, the Chinese have had lots and lots of rules of thumb for a very long time.
It's literally the basis of East Asian culture. That's the basis of Confucianism.
Congratulations, science. You have rediscovered what people already knew for thousands of years.
Yes. It's literally.
And Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize for that.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's really, you know, there are certain things in terms of that some of these heuristics are woven into our thinking in terms of loss aversion or negativity bias.
Yeah.
But a lot of this stuff has already been known for a long time. And so it's very much like Castle Mine Forex, where you can walk to the watering hole and you can, you know, try and suck moisture from a frog. But in practice, very often the answer is sitting right there and you can have a delicious Australian beer.
Or squeeze blood from a stone.
Yeah, squeeze blood from a stone, which is a lot of what people are trying to do. And this is not humanity's first rodeo, and so there are these timeless expressions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I'm Tiangao Huangdi Yuan. You know, the world's going to do what it's going to do. So you do the best that you can do while you're here, right? I mean,
how much ability does any of us have the ability to control the actions of any emperor, whether that emperor is Donald Trump or Brian Callen?
Well, speaking of Brian Callen and that exact idea, Brian Callen himself, the great, the great man, spoke of his father, Big Mike. Literally, Big Mike is not dead, but he's up in the sky looking down upon us.
but that in terms of
and but he said that his father told him, you can't give grown adults advice. And I've listened, full disclosure, I've listened to way too many podcasts.
well, but that's part of being in the military, right?
Yeah. You have a lot of time punctuated by short bursts of intense action. But you can't give grown people advice. You can give them ideas. You can show them, hey, this is what you're doing. I can see where this might go. Don't do this, that, or the other, but I'm just trying to show you something, man. You don't give people advice. People will not listen to advice.
Well, and crucially, I mean, I had a very nice conversation with Brian's wife, actually, about how so much of all you can really do for people is to clarify their choices and say, you could do this or you could do this. You know, if you do this, you're likely to get this result.
There's a rap song like that. You could do with this, you could do with that.
Yeah.
And you can do with this. Yeah.
So you can't, and you know, it's insulting to tell adults what to think.
Oh, yeah. It treats us like children, and that's one of the huge problems
in
the military.
But even children don't like being treated like that. Children being hate past a certain age, they hate being told what to think, and especially teenagers. So you're like, listen, and that is, it very much comes down to what you're saying. I mean, in terms of tutoring, you're just like, listen, you can do this if you want. This is how it's going to pan out for you, right?
Yeah.
You can, you know, hate school, not study, not learn anything. But how do you think that's going to work out in an economy that's literally called the knowledge economy?
Yeah.
Do you think you're going to be getting a lot of money and a nice car and all the things that you want? No, you're probably not.
Or do you even think you're going to figure out what you want unless you try and figure out where you are?
Yeah.
It's that old saying from The Art of War. The Art of War is classical Chinese. I can't speak classical Chinese. It's like reading ye olde English, but worse, because there's no phonetics.
Yeah.
But the translation of that one, know your enemy, know yourself, and you will not seek peril. That whole old paradigm, that's so true on so many levels, because you got to basically understand that you don't know yourself. So you don't know who the enemy is. So without knowing yourself and without knowing your enemy, you're basically lost.
Yeah. And so the point, it very much like, and that's a lot of what we've sort of been talking about. And what's cool and part of what we talked about last night is the degree to which Brian and I have sort of been having conversations, but then sort of blasting them out into the internet and not knowing if anybody was listening and not knowing whether we were being heard. And so I, for example, have had a tendency to endlessly reiterate certain points because I'm like, are people getting this?
Hunter, if you build it,
they will come. And if that, and now here we are sitting, looking over Emperor Callan's kingdom. The Callan fate. Callan Huangdi. and let me tell you that once again, the emperor is, heaven is high and the emperor is far away. it's very cool to suddenly realize that, I don't have to endlessly repeat myself because people are getting it. And probably this will change my verbal tics. I'll probably stop saying right so much.
Right.
Because I won't be constantly checking in to hear whether people are hearing me.
Well, I think you're at a place right now where people are starting to listen. You're no longer the guy on the street corner with the sign saying the world is ending. You are now somebody. You're now somebody with people who are following you. So
I mean, you said last night in terms of the movement is starting to put down roots. Right.
Yeah.
There's enough of a tribe. We start to have enough of a structure. And now it's a different set of work because now it's like, OK, we've got all these ideas. Now we have to evolve some sort of clear, cohesive message.
Yeah. Do you think nowadays people's Dunbar number is increasing?
I don't know that I think that's the Facebook, I think, is a great demonstration of that it hasn't. I think that, you know, because I got on Facebook right in 2004 and
I was there.
And I, you know, went nuts like everybody went nuts and befriended 5,000 people. And then now it's like running up against that Dunbar number, that neurological limit of just being like, who the fuck are these people? Where do I know them from?
Yeah. Every now and then I go through it and I can keep track. I can remember stories about probably about 500 people.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was there with them doing this. But I asked that question because don't we use tools to circumvent evolution in a lot of ways?
Yeah, to work around those limits.
Yeah, to work around those limits. And so with social media, it's basically like using the first pen to write on paper to increase our efficacy in storytelling and learning.
Yep. Well, and I mean, like you're saying, like, for example, even as you say that, I remember somebody that I went to college with that I basically spent no time with in college, but we did have one crazy night together.
Yeah.
And so, you know, his name and like, if I saw him, I'd be able to spark a conversation by retelling that story.
Yeah.
And then we would be able to work into a relationship. So, but we don't have those stories with everybody.
Yeah. And crucially, like, there are a number of Dunbar numbers.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, I mean, that's part of why I started saying the Dunbar numbers.
Yeah.
Because there is, you know, there's besties. You know, the way I describe it is there's besties. There's the guys you would invite to your bachelor party, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the difference between those is that a lot of the guys you would invite to their bachelor party, you wouldn't actually feel comfortable spilling your guts to or talking about something emotionally uncomfortable. So if the marriage then fails, you wouldn't talk to necessarily all the guys who went to the bachelor party. You would go back to talking to the besties.
Yeah.
And then you circle out towards, you know, the tribe of 150. And then there are 4,000 acquaintances.
Yeah.
So there's a series of interlocking Dunbar numbers. But at a certain point, even people who are amazing at memorizing names, someone like Bill Clinton, they don't really have a relationship with the vast majority of
those people. That's a skill that he probably developed over time.
Very specifically because of the job that he's in.
Yeah.
It's valuable to remember.
It's a tool that is useful
for
his task at hand.
That's right.
Speaking of that and, you know, heuristics, I do sincerely believe that all people are created equal, be it by the coincidence of your DNA or by some flying spaghetti monster.
He was boiled. His noodly appendage touches us all.
Yeah, he was boiled for our sins.
I hadn't heard that part. I am a devout Pastafarian. I will say that.
No, but the thing about that is all people are put on this planet some way or another, and they're just trying to get along with the environment that they're in. Like, this is what annoys me when, like, you listen to the great Brian Kellen and his chief disciple, Brennan Schaub, talk. I love them both. If they were here, I'm sure we would be having a grand old time.
They would be grooming each other physically.
Yes, also that. But when they talk about, you know, people aren't equal, man, or that, you know, I'm never gonna be LeBron James in a game of basketball. Well, you're playing a fucking game.
Yeah, it's also they're comparing dumb things. So it's funny because this morning I was going through our interview with Jared Diamond to just pull out some clips.
Yeah, that was a good one.
It was an amazing one. All due credit to him. But also,
very interesting man.
He's an amazing man. And part of one of the clips that I was pulling out was that story that Jared Diamond told about. He's like, listen, you compare people and you can focus on these superficial differences and you can look at, okay, there's skin color differences, there's the shape of the face, there's hair color, there's hair shape. And then there's, you know, you can look even at biochemical differences. People process alcohol differently. They process food differently. But these differences are all superficial. And they don't get to the core of what we now know, 100 plus episodes on from Joe Henrich, the secret of our success, which is that humans have the ability to upload culture from their environment.
Yeah.
And the example that Diamond gives is that great example. He says, listen, people in the Papua New Guinean Highlands have been isolated for 46,000 years. And you would think that maybe there would be some genetic changes that were related to the ability to acquire writing or acquire computer skills. And he said, but I started off working with the 4A tribe. And there I met, and you know, one day he's in some I can't remember, mining camp or oil camp or whatever, and there's a young 4A man in the next hut over who's doing all sorts of crazy engineering stuff with this computer. And you know, that he's like a level of computer skill that is so far beyond what I, Jared Diamond, could do.
Yeah.
And that's because the brain, in terms of the ways that really matter, that hardware's ability to use social intelligence to upload culture in one generation is able to boom, upload, catch up.
Yeah.
And that's what, I'm sorry, Brendan Schaub, I love you. But you haven't read all the relevant biology. And apparently nor has Little White Sambo.
Who's Little White Sambo?
That's what I'm calling Sam Harris now.
Oh, Jesus. I don't... Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ, no.
No. Sambo. Sambo is a very, very charged word.
Well, exactly, and especially Little White Sambo.
Oh,
but
that,
the point is to be...
The world is a strange place, and I understand exactly the analogy that you're using, and that's why I'm like, oh my God.
But that's the key, is to emotionally charge these ideas so that attention is drawn to them.
Yes.
So let's be provocative. Let's be intellectual terrorists. And
let's
draw people to the relevant biology so they can decide for
themselves.
Let's
be Dutch.
Let's be Dutch about this shit.
No, yeah. Why would you not want to say that the emperor has no clothes? Of course, if it was Brian Kellen and he didn't have any clothes, the world would be enriched.
Exactly.
But at the same time, you got to point out things that
that people in power don't want pointed out.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily demonize the people in power. I would just demonize our ways of thinking in a lot of ways, because our brains, I feel like our brains aren't necessarily equipped for the amount of information that we're getting thrown at us all the time. So we have to chunk and, you know, put things in these boxes in a way that doesn't necessarily benefit us.
Yeah, and I mean, and the point is to evolve a better culture, and it's not to demonize anybody.
Oh yeah,
there's a system, there's a culture, and this is sort of, you know, your hero Chris Ryan,
Uncle Chris. So the paradigms are that Hunter is not Toto. He's Jiminy Cricket. Brian Callen, the great, is Pinocchio, just trying to figure out his place in the world. And one
and
day,
hoping that he can be a real-life boy, at least, and then maybe be a real-life man.
Yeah. And Chris Ryan's Geppetto. He's seen it all before, and he wants to do the best that he can.
But I listened to Chris Ryan's episode with Nate West.
Yeah.
And one of the things he talks about is that, you know, people often, when you look at a corporation behaves poorly.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, individual members of that system are evil.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, the corporation takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
It is this sort of larger intelligence. And you could remove a particular CEO,
yeah,
but it wouldn't matter because the next guy would suddenly find himself in that role and forced and pressured. So the point is that Little White Sambo, Derek Zoolander, or even Richard Dawkins, the upper class twit, they're not. It's not that they're bad people. It's that they have evolved into a certain role that they're playing within the system.
Yeah,
and they exploited the ecological niche of their needing to be famous science popularizers.
Yes.
And now they've created another ecological niche for either Toto/Jiminy Cricket and for Mixed Mental Arts to come along and package the ideas in a more cohesive form and outcompete them, or at least make them forced to compete and raise their game.
Yeah. I don't know. I've never met Sam Harris, but...
Nor have I.
But... By the way that he talks, it just sounds so pompous, man. It's like Have you ever been to the Middle East, man? I don't think he has. It's like, you can't, there's a Chinese saying, Bai Wen Bu Ru Yi Jian. Hearing about it 100 times is incomparable to seeing it once.
Well, I would agree with that, because having seen the Middle East more than once, but even I haven't had that much experience in the Middle East, but I have had enough experience in the Middle East to know that he is not giving a realistic sense of what's going on the ground.
Yeah.
And the person that I interviewed before you was this guy, Mohammed, and I'm gonna do the Ghain, but Mohammed Ghilan, because I butcher all the languages.
Yes.
I speak all of them well enough to impress people who know the language not at all.
Yes.
But enough that anybody who speaks the language well is like, man, there are so many problems with your accent.
And that's what fluency is.
Yeah. It's the ability to fool people. And that's why always when people ask me the question, how many languages do you speak? And I'm like, that's a difficult question because they're all in various states of disrepair.
Yeah.
And then they're like, but come on, how many can you speak? And I'm like, well, if I can give you a number. And then I give them a number. And then they're like, are you fluent in all of those? And then I'm like, I know enough about language to know how problematic that question is. So, but anyway, Mohammed was talking about, you know, what are the actual problems in Saudi Arabia or Yemen or any of these places?
Yeah.
And he's like, what's so fucking annoying about people like Sam Harris talking about the religion thing is that if you actually look at the problems of Saudi, it's that they don't have good state structures. They don't. There's lots of corruption. It's all about nepotism and connections.
Yeah.
And
Guanxi.
Yeah, it's Guanxi, right? And that's a systemic problem across a lot of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so easy to, you know, who succeeds in the ecological niche of Twitter and television is a guy who can go on and say some super simplistic shit that is impressive to people like Bill Maher.
I think it's more so Sam Harris wouldn't have been able to get to the top of, you know, that the culture that he's a part of, if it was 1950, because he's an atheist and he uses his atheism as a way to demonize people of belief, especially being 1950 with the Cold War and, you know, the godless communists, he wouldn't have gotten any traction. I think what we're seeing now is a fact of people who are so disillusioned and influenceable, because it's like, once you figure out the emperor has no clothes, you're like, am I wearing clothes? So people are looking for clothes to wear. And Sam Harris is providing him a tunic.
And that's the point of fundamentalism. It provides you with some sort of clarity in a time when you feel like you suddenly don't have clarity.
Yeah.
And that's appealing. But I think the opportunity is that, whether we like it or not, and this sort of all connects back, we now need a larger myth. We now need a larger belief system that makes sense of the full range of human experience. The full
detribalization.
Range of culture. Yeah, detribalization from our old tribe, and then the evolution of a better...
Well, detribalization of individual tribes into one great tribe.
Yep, a tribe called human.
A tribe called Quest?
A Tribe Called Quest. See, that's, I mean, listen, I mean, how awesome if a tribe called, I would call it a Tribe Called Quest. And actually, a Tribe Called Quest is maybe a better name, because the point is that you will always be on a quest.
Yeah.
It's just stolen.
Well it's, yeah, totally jacked. But there's a lot of awesome wisdom within that, because a Tribe Called Quest took jazz, put it to a hip hop beat, and made some of the best music ever made in America, you know? And those guys who made that music were scholars of that specific style. They listen to all the freaking records, man.
So maybe can we get a Tribe Called Quest on here and just be like, hey, well, can we borrow your name / rally under your banner?
Unfortunately, Five Dog has passed, but I think Q-Tip might
be down.
Might
with
be
it.
Down. Might
well,
be down.
It, Q-Tip, if you're out there, you know, we already have an emperor. But, you know, you could be the official court musician to the thousand-year dragon, Brian Callen.
And that the beauty of the Callen fate and the son of heaven, Brian Callen,
Which then, if Brian Callen is the son of heaven, then that just means Mike Callen is just straight up heaven.
Oh, yeah. He's Tien. That's why he's in what, Utah, in the high,
that's
high
right.
desert. What was the point? Oh, no, there's a point. It's coming. The point is that Brian Callen was not seeking to be the leader of the Callen faith. No. We have decided that he must be the leader.
That's right. Like a truly great leader.
But like hunter-gatherers.
Like hunter-gatherers. That's right. He's being appointed. And the tribe can then steal that role from him.
He's our Cincinnatus.
Exactly. But by the way, I'm now that we've established that Mike Callen is Tien, right? So heaven, Mike Callen is high. He's in Utah, as you said.
Yes.
And Brian Callen is far away. He may actually only be about 20 minutes from here, but he's remarkably remote and inaccessible.
Time and space, man.
That's
They're
right.
inextricably
linked.
Linked.
ladies and gentlemen, I think that is a beautiful note on which to end this.
Yes.
Isaiah, thank you so much for making me slightly less bad at Chinese.
We can diffuse our innovations together, Hunter.
That's exciting. And listen, that's the point, is that there's all, the Castle Mind 4X of heuristics from many cultures and many times and places is sitting right there.
Yeah.
So if you want to walk to some shitty watering hole and then suck moisture out of a toad, feel free to do that. But what we're going to do is be setting up a beer stand where you can just get it much more conveniently and in a much tastier form.
And it's cooperation and it's organic and it's beautiful.
Yep. All that good stuff. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Thank you so much to our ambassador from the Qin Dynasty.
Yes. Can I make...
you can do whatever the fuck you want.
I'm a completely self-serving, self-promoting...
Do it.
Asshole. Like I said earlier, I wrote, recorded, and published on Bandcamp a record. It's called Songs from the Heart. My band is called Great Ghouls and the Soulless, emphasis on the Great Ghouls, because that's a thing off my last name. And you can find it at greatghouls.bandcamp.com.
And I've listened to it, and it's awesome. And I think also part of what we talked about is that maybe you might be making some songs around some of these ideas, which I think would be super fun. I know that Nate McCabe is also working on some songs around these ideas, and I think that would be amazing, is if we can start to get some music in the Callen Faith.
Well, that speaks back to the Renaissance, man. Like Da Vinci was a great artist and a great engineer, and I don't think you'd have the Mona Lisa if he wasn't dissecting humans.
Yeah, I mean, because he understood the anatomy well enough to be able to paint it.
And speaking of artists, I have one more thing to mention. I have a friend who does a comic. It's in its fifth chapter. It's called PhD Unknown. If you just Google PhD Unknown, it's a wonderful little web comic, and you'll enjoy it.
Awesome. And I think that's the...
Especially if you enjoy relevant biology.
Oh, Jesus. Maybe I can understand it. If it's broken down in comic form, then maybe even Jiminy Cricket can understand it.
Yes.
That's really the point. There's a lot of great stuff that already exists out there. The Wisdom of Crowds exists. There is PhD Unknown. There's, your music is already available. There's lots and lots of stuff that's already out there.
People are going to find a way.
Exactly. And so all we're trying to do is to bring together the Wisdom of Crowds so that it can, create, cooperate, collaborate, borrow, steal like an artist, and just constantly be evolving more carne asada french fries.
Yes.
So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, go make carne asada french fries and present them to the emperor.
Yes. Supplicate.
Supplicate to the emperor. And I guarantee you that you will have a much better reception than the British did when they offered their wares to the Chinese emperor.
Yes.
All right. Over and out, guys. Thanks so much. Thanks so much to Isaiah. And I'll see you all on the internet.